Good morning. You are listening to Lowell Association for Blinds, LAB Radio. LAB Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network, your main source of accessible community news and information. Located in Lowell, Massachusetts, we read local news, editorials, feature stories, and more. LAB Radio is brought to you by volunteers and staff at the Lowell Association for the Blind. This is Barry, and I'll be reading you today from the Lowell Sun and later from the Lawrence Eagle Tribune. LAB would like to thank the Nancy L. and Richard K. Donahue Charitable Foundation for their support. Hope you're doing well this morning. This is a Lowell Sun, Thursday, July 30th, 2026. The top story is of the haunting 911 call, recording of Patrick Clancy's call played in court. It's by Colleen Cronin from the Boston Herald. Patrick Clancy, the ex-husband of a Duxbury mom on trial for allegedly murdering her kids, was excused from the witness stand Wednesday before prosecutors played the 911 recording of him discovering his three young children strangled in his basement. The father had come home on a January night in 2023 after picking up takeout and one of the kids' medicines to find the house unusually quiet. Heading upstairs, he found his bedroom door locked. "That's when I knew something was wrong," Patrick Clancy said on the stand. When he finally got inside, he found the room covered in blood, the bed pushed away from the wall, and the window opened. The 911 call, which was played in open court after Patrick Clancy was excused, picks up when he finds his then-wife and defendant, Lindsay Clancy, below the second-story window, lying on the ground with cuts to her neck and wrists and appearing to come in and out of consciousness. She had jumped out of the window and fallen about 20 feet, Patrick Clancy tells the 911 operator. "My wife tried to commit suicide," he told the dispatcher, who asks about her breathing, bleeding, and speech. The bleeding had appeared to stop, and although she was breathing and could speak, Patrick Clancy reports to the dispatcher that she was not talking normally. It's hard to make out her voice on the recording. "Lindsay, wake up," he says to her. "They're coming. They're coming. Look at me. Say my name. Say my name." Sirens can be heard getting louder and louder, and when the first responders arrive to tell somebody, "I need to go check on my kids." On the stand, he told the prosecutors he didn't realize that he'd stayed on the line with the operator, and for a few moments, the call only records a sound of him running inside and down the basement stairs. "Guys," he calls out. Then he begins to scream. He screams a children's name, Cora, 5, Dawson, 3, 8-month-old Callan, he would find a few moments later, he testified. All three children had exercise bands tied around their necks. Assistant District Attorney Jennifer Sprague held up each band in court to show the jury after Patrick Clancy was excused. "Come to the basement right now," he says to the operator. "She's killed the kids." "She killed the kids?" the dispatcher says, almost a question, then says to himself more quietly, "Holy expletive." After the 911 call ended, at least one juror was crying, along with several people in the audience. The judge called a recess. Lindsay Clancy was sobbing in court with her head folded over the table. As she was pushed out of the courtroom in her wheelchair, the fall from the window paralyzed her. She said, "Oh, my God." Patrick Clancy came back on the stand later in the afternoon to be cross-examined by his ex-wife's attorney, Kevin Reddington. In his opening statement, Reddington argued that his client was a mother whose mental health spiraled into postpartum psychosis and that a bevy of medications she was prescribed only made things worse. He described the defendant as a dedicated parent. "She did everything. She started reading them books at 3 months. She made up songs for them," he testified. "I remember she used to make green eggs and ham for Cora because she liked that book." Photos of the family home showed a dining room turned into a play area for the kids with a sign that read, "It's a Wonderful Life." The kids' rooms were covered in artwork, decorations from cartoons, and photos. Having Patrick Clancy go through the pictures from the defendant's social media of the family appearing happy and smiling, Reddington said the witness could take a moment if it became too difficult. It was pretty gradual, he described, telling the court how her anxiety over returning to work after giving birth to their third child led to a prescription for the antidepressant Zoloft, which seemed to cause insomnia. Then a different SSRI was prescribed. She had changed providers twice before returning to her initial doctor. The worst of the problems were in December when Lindsay Clancy disclosed to him that she was worried she might harm the children. Reddington presented a photo of a book titled Good Moms Have Scary Thoughts and one of his clients' notebooks. Horrible, intrusive thoughts, she wrote in one entry with a date and a list of her medicines and their dosage. In another, she jotted down, slept well, horrible thoughts in the morning. Then at the end of the month, she was hospitalized at McLean after expressing suicidal thoughts. She was scared. She didn't want to go, Patrick Clancy testified. I said she had to go. When being questioned by the prosecutor, he said that she seemed like she was getting better in January 2023 after that stay. He also said she didn't express that she wanted to harm or kill the children then. Did anyone ever tell you not to leave your kids alone with Lindsay? ADA Sprague asked. No, he replied. The trial would be resumed Thursday morning at 9 a.m. Second big story on page one, divided council votes to fence in Monument Square. Free speech zone public space to move behind wrought iron fence. In a closely divided 6-5 vote, city council moved to restrict public access to the grounds of the Ladd and Whitney Monument, a triangular-shaped piece of land located in front of City Hall. The motion was brought forward by Mayor Eric Gitchier at the Tuesday night meeting and requested city manager Tom Golden look at funding sources to reinstall the wrought iron fence that historically surrounded the space decades ago. The 27.5-foot-tall granite obelisk contains the graves of Luther Ladd and Addison Whitney, who were killed in Baltimore on April 19, 1861, in a rush to Washington, D.C. to defend the Capitol in the early days of the Civil War. Besides Ladd and Whitney, 644 more Lowellians died in the bloody conflict. We're taxed with preserving that area, Gitcher said from the floor after he yielded the chair to Vice Mayor Vesna Noon. People climb on the gravesite as they did over the weekend during the Lowell Folk Fest. The mayor of Lowell is a ceremonial or honorific title. The office is not elected by the voters, and the mayor has no more legislative power than his other 10 peers on the council. A sign was posted on the property during Lowell's Folk Festival this past weekend asking people not to climb on the monuments. People climb all over it, Gitcher said. They throw trash on it, and they stomp on someone's grave. There are 20 memorials on and surrounding the grounds of City Hall, including the Cambodian Genocide Memorial, the Lao American Monument, and the 9/11 Memorial. Crowds picnicked around these and other memorial monuments during the Folk Festival while listening to the performances at the Rockland Trust Bank Dance Pavilion on Arcan Drive. None of these monuments, page two, or memorials are fenced off. The triangular public land of the Ladd and Whitney Monument, known as Monument Square, is also home to the Arcan Memorial and the Winged Victory Statue. Slightly raised parcel sits at the highly visible intersection of Merrimack Street and Arcan Drive in downtown Lowell. Its location makes it a prime location for groups holding events such as protests or sign-holding for political campaigns without blocking the street or sidewalk. The city also uses the space and has posted signs announcing citywide initiatives such as the 25-mile-per-hour speed limit law. That visibility mostly takes place in front of the Winged Victory statue facing Arcan Drive, says Joseph Boyle, a member of the Solidarity Lowell Coordinating Committee, who spoke in favor of a protective fencing around the actual gravestone of the monument itself. Solidarity Lowell is a volunteer group of community members to Greater Lowell working towards social justice by defending the human rights, dignity, and equality of all persons against all forms of hate and discrimination. Boyle recalled gathering at the monument after the Unite the Right rally, a white supremacist event that took place in Charlottesville, Virginia in 2017. Heather Heyer was killed by a self-identified white supremacist who drove into the crowd of people protesting the rally. 35 other people were injured. I was inspired to tell the story of Privates Ladd and Whitney and how they died at the hands of pro-Confederate mob and point out that Heather Heyer had been killed by the same white supremacist evil that had killed the Lowellians lying underneath the gravestone, he said. He said better signage could also be installed to alert the public to the history and significance of the monument. It is not immediately obvious that it's a gravestone, Boyle said. Several councillors objected to fencing around the entire parcel that would start at the edge of the sidewalk. To have the fencing on the whole island, I'm just concerned. Where is a free speech zone for people who want to do their speech in protest? He suggested a fence around the monument, but not the whole island. Councillors Rita Mercier, Belinda Duran, and Steve Sean McDonough echoed that thought, with Mercier saying she was in favor of a decorative fence around the monument itself to give honor to the people that are buried there. It's a free speech zone, Mercier said. Veterans have a service there on Memorial Day, and they go right up to the stone. McDonough supported a monument-specific fence versus a perimeter fence, but also said closing off the public square was not something he could vote for. I don't see the need to restrict one of the very few patches of grass downtown beyond what is necessary, and still show respect, he said. Each year, the brave service members from Lowell who gave their life defending their country since the American Civil War are honored during a Memorial Day flag planting ceremony at the Ladd and Whitney Monument. 1,278 flags painted in memory of the city's fallen soldiers. Mercier asked how veterans and other groups would access the grounds for that purpose with a perimeter fence surrounding the land. Gitcher said that while he didn't have all the answers, any access to the site would be up to the city. In a roll call vote, councillors Sidney Lang, Kim Scott, McDonough, Nguyen, and Duran voted no. Councillors Corey Robinson, Dan Rourke, Corey Chow, John Desco, Mercier, and Gichier voted yes, and the motion passed. And the last, that was by Melanie Gilbert of the Lowell Sun, by the way. The last story on the front page here is about transit, spilling the tea. MBTA announces continuation of summer and new savings for commuter rail subway buses. And this is by Grace Zakovich of the Boston Herald. The MBTA announced a new range of affordability initiatives for subway and bus riders this fall, along with discounts on the commuter rail continued from pilot programs over the summer. Today, we're making more progress on making life more affordable for people by offering these tremendous cost savings, Governor Maura Healey said on Tuesday. I know that over the next few months, people are going to save $100, upwards to $600 over the next couple of months. Beginning in the fall, the MBTA will offer three new affordability pilot programs for riders, along with two summer commuter rail discounts extended through November, the governor and MBTA officials announced at Belmont Commuter Rail Station Tuesday morning. The three fare pilots include an expanded two-hour window for unlimited transfers between bus, subway, and ferry service, elimination of the current higher fare on express bus routes, and free fares for car-free seniors 75 plus who no longer drive. The 2-hour window and express bus fare pilots will begin in September and last for 6 months. The car-free seniors pilot start date will be announced this fall, the administration said. The expanded transfer window will allow riders to transfer between bus, subway, and ferry trips a practically unlimited number of times within 2 hours, paying once for the highest cost service, the MBTA said. The rider must use the same payment method on all trips to avoid paying for multiple trips. For instance, if you're using the Lynn Ferry, that might be the highest price route, said MBTA GM Philip Eng. It's only a 50-minute trip. Guess what? You still have to jump on a different mode when you get to your destination and take advantage of the unlimited transfer windows. You want to pick up a prescription. You want to jump off the system, grab your prescription, jump back on, drop off a child at daycare. Currently, riders are only limited to 2 free transfers between the bus and subway during a 2-hour window with other limitations. Under the Express Bus Fare Pilot, page 4, the MBTA's 7 express routes will be discounted from their current higher fare, $4.25 full fare and $2.10 reduced to normal route cost $1.70 full and 85 cents reduced. Estimates show the program may save riders nearly $500 in the 6 months period, the MBTA said. The car-free seniors program in partnership with the RMV will offer free fares to residents 75 years old and older who have a Massachusetts ID and not a driver's license. The free fare credentials will apply to all bus, subway, ferry, and commuter rail services. For older adults, the T is not just about independence, it's about getting about safely, said Healy. It's about being more connected to family, to medical appointments, and other activities that they need and that they can now do for free. The MBTA launched several commuter rail pilot savings programs, including free summer programs, extended weekend travel for pass holders, which will end in August. However, 2 more programs will continue through November. Riders will be able to access a 50% discount for monthly commuter rail passes in September, October, and November, the administration said. The passes can typically cost between $80 and $426, depending on which services and zones riders use. Monthly commuter rail pass holders will also be able to continue to bring one companion on weekend trips for $1 each way through the companion fare program. Friday commuter rail ridership has increased 50%, and riders have taken more than 6,200 companion trips since the start of the program, Healy said of the summer initiatives. It's a huge success, makes a huge difference for people, and I thought it was really important that we continue this. Officials herald recent upgrades and investments at the MBTA, including removal of slow zones, new cars in service, and upgrades to the Foxborough Community Rail Station. Asked about the potential to expand hours, which the MBTA did for some events over the summer, Eng said the T would need to ensure continued investment, more operators, and the ability to continue maintenance. Expanded hours is something that we know folks would enjoy, said Eng. We saw it during the summer. And I know so many restaurants and businesses told me how important that has been, even the extended Friday and Saturdays that we've done. So we're going to continuously look at that. But I just want to put the expectations that we have a little work to do still. More information on the pilots can be found on the MBTA.com site. And that's what we have on page 1. We have a big picture of the free speech zone at Lowell Town Hall. All right. We also have here on page 2, lottery hits $1 billion in net profit. Critical local aid for every community by Gail Colley from the Boston Herald. State officials said the Massachusetts lottery generated more than $1 billion in net profit for the 6th year in a row, but fell short of profit projections due to the record jackpot payouts. Massachusetts Treasurer Deborah Goldberg said Tuesday that the state lottery produced $1.045 billion in net profit for the state in the last fiscal year that ended June 30th. The total profit was based on the gaming revenue that came in at 5 $1.904 billion. Administrative costs that cut into that revenue by roughly 2.4% or $141.7 million and distributed lottery winnings. Thanks to our retail partners, loyal customers, and the lottery team, we are able to provide critical local aid for every community in Massachusetts, Goldberg said in a statement. With this week's launch of online lottery, we will build on our success while supporting early childhood education and care, expanding the lottery's positive impact across the state. Net profit fell $5 million below Goldberg's projection of $1.05 billion and was $22 million less than the prior fiscal year. The lottery paid out 74.19% of its revenue to players as prizes, which it described Tuesday as a record amount for the 50-year state organization. For the sixth year in a row, we're proud to deliver over $1 billion to our cities and towns thanks to our customers, employers, and statewide network of retail partners, Mass Lottery Executive Director Mark William Bracken said in a statement. Powerball and some of our in-state draw games help boost profits, as well as Keno reaching a new record in sales. Mass Lottery players won an estimated $4.379 billion, largely driven by two Powerball jackpots that exceeded $1 billion last fiscal year, compared to just one jackpot that hit the $1 billion mark the prior fiscal year. State lottery players won 140 prizes valued at $1 million or more between 136 scratch tickets and 10 Powerball tickets. The largest prize won last fiscal year was $25 million on the $25 million Mega Money scratch ticket that sells for $50 according to the lottery. Wow. Bracken told the State House News Service that last year's record prize payout percentage clearly takes a cut into our net profit, but is really good news for our players. Also affecting profit margins were a dip in scratch ticket sales, which typically represent two-thirds of lottery sales. Scratch ticket sales fell by 3.7%, or $145.6 million, totaling $3.808 billion per State House News reporting. The lottery highlighted in its press statement that sales were up elsewhere, while only sharing the scratch ticket of the sales amount. Draw game sales totaled $758.7 million, representing a 12.2% increase over prior year's $676.2 million. Keno set an all-time high with $1.288 billion in total sales, eclipsing the prior fiscal year's then-record sales total of $1.285 million, excuse me, according to the lottery. The lottery said its network of retailers earned $337.1 million in commissions and bonuses last fiscal year. State officials said they are hoping to see a future boost in profits with the launch of Massachusetts Lottery Online, featuring new and familiar games that registered players 21 and older can play on their phones, computer, or tablet throughout the lottery's app and official website. Where Bracken said, we're excited to have revenue already coming in from online sales and look forward to seeing those net profits support early childhood educational grants. And the other story on page two is U.S. bans foreign-made humanoid robots. The U.S. Federal Communications Commission is banning imports of new foreign-made humanoid robots and power inverters, citing national security risks in a move that targets China. Beijing quickly accused U.S. of protectionism. The measures are likely to test relations with Beijing ahead of a planned U.S. visit by Chinese leader Xi Jinping to meet with U.S. President Donald Trump in September. China dominates the global market for humanoid robots with an estimated market share of roughly 85%. The FCC's ban also includes new imports of quadruped robots, also referred to as four-legged robot dogs. The agency said imports of advanced robots posed cybersecurity and other national security risks. Offshore production of such equipment also leaves U.S. supply chains vulnerable to disruptions. The ban on power inverters, which are used to convert direct current DC electricity into alternating current AC electricity, and are used in renewable energy systems, data centers, and household appliances, could have sweeping ramifications. FCC Chairperson Brendan Carr said Tuesday that the move was to secure America's critical supply chains. He said the bans apply to new versions of such imports. The FCC's ban follows a slew of U.S. restrictions on imports of Chinese products, including drones, and on exports of U.S. advanced technology to China. The U.S. is also weighing controls on use of Chinese open source and artificial intelligence models at a time when Chinese AI is rapidly gaining ground. It's a steady drumbeat of potential flashpoints heading into the Trump-Xi summit planned for September, said Sam Sachs, senior fellow at the New America think tank focused on Chinese technological policies. China has been rapidly expanding the use of robots, with policies supporting its technology sector. Morgan Stanley analysts forecast its market for humanoids could reach $15 billion by 2030. Chinese manufacturers have been scaling production and reducing costs faster than most overseas competitors, said analyst Kang Shuk Chao Li at Morningstar. Restricting their access to U.S. removes an important future market and protects U.S. developers from potential price competition, he said. However, it will not materially slow China's overall humanoid development, given the size of its domestic manufacturing base and opportunities in other export markets. Of the around 15,000 humanoid robots shipped globally in 2025, Unitree and Agibot, two of China's largest advanced robotics companies, each ship more than 5,000. Their U.S. counterparts like Tesla and Figure AI each shipped a few hundred or less, according to the technology research and advisory group Omidia. And on page 3, Wilmington man at center of Concord crash that killed elderly couple. Authorities say driver crossed center line before head-on collision. It's by Aaron Curtis of the Lowell Sun. An 82-year-old man and his 85-year-old wife were killed Saturday afternoon after police say a Wilmington driver crossed the double yellow line and struck their vehicle head-on. The crash happened at about 1 p.m. on Walden Street near Brister's Hill Road, where police and firefighters arrived to find a Honda Accord and a Tesla Model 3 heavily damaged and 5 people injured, according to a press release from Middlesex District Attorney's Office. The Honda was driven by a 25-year-old Wilmington man who was transported to a local hospital and remains hospitalized. His name was not released by authorities. Inside the Tesla were 4 occupants, the driver, John Hamilton, 82, and his wife, Paula Hamilton, 85, both of Concord, were flown by medical helicopter to Leahy Hospital and Medical Center in Burlington, where they later died from their injuries. 2 additional passengers in the Tesla, both 28 and visiting from Tacoma, Washington, were taken to a local hospital. Both have since been released. Their names have not been released by authorities. Investigators with the Middlesex District Attorney's Office, the Concord Police, and State Police Collision Analysis and Reconstruction Sections said early evidence indicates the Honda and Tesla were traveling in opposite directions when the Honda allegedly crossed the center line and struck the Tesla head-on. Crash remains under active investigation. In Tingsboro, 500 megawatt battery storage facility is coming to Tingsboro by Prudence Brighton, a correspondent. Battery energy storage is coming to Tingsboro. and with it the potential for the town to reap substantial financial benefit over the next two decades. Rhineland Energy, a New York City-based development firm, which develops battery energy storage systems, provided the select board with a project overview at its July 27th meeting. The firm is currently working on several projects in New York and was one of the four enterprises selected for the right to operate in Massachusetts. The project does not require planning board approval. The 506 Middlesex Road site is industrially zoned, which grants by right status to projects like this. Rhineland is still working out the details with the town, but town manager Colin Loisel said the facility would mean at least $2 million annually for 20 years as payment in lieu of taxes. In a statement to The Sun, Loisel said the battery storage facility proposed for 406 Middlesex Road represents a new use for a long vacant parcel of land that promises to generate significant local revenue to support the town's operating budget. Loisel added, Tingsboro's public safety teams have intensely scrutinized the project and feel confident that it poses no elevated or unique risk to our community. The Tingsboro Fire Department continues to work with the development to ensure public safety remains a top priority. Representing Rhineland Energy at the select board meeting, Brian Benito, vice president of the project development, said these projects are highly sought after for the Commonwealth. They bridge the intermittency gap between renewable energy and traditional fossil fuels. BESS tanks take excess power from renewable energy installations and hold it. When the sun isn't shining and the wind isn't blowing, that stored power is distributed to the grid, Benito said. Rhineland's Tingsboro's project, designated River Mill Storage, is expected to provide 500 megawatts of emissions-free power to the region. Massachusetts has set a goal of 5,000 megawatts of power through the BESS system by 2030. Benito compared its capacity to a small nuclear power plant. Because of the importance of these projects to the state, Benito said, we have made the commitments we would normally have made to the town. This project has been highly reviewed already. Fire Chief Wes Russell told the select board that the proposal presents little risk to public safety. Its boundaries include Middlesex Road and Route 3 with residential and commercial properties at a safe distance. He has also reviewed safety considerations in construction of the storage tanks and is satisfied with what he has seen. BESS systems have been in the news lately with a controversial 125-megawatt proposal in Tewksbury, recently gaining final approval from the state and several small communities in the Neshoba Valley forming a consortium to provide 70 megawatts. The Tingsboro project has had a smoother path so far that Tingsboro than the Tewksbury, let me try again. The Tingsboro project has had a smoother path so far than Tewksbury proposal because the site has by right status for projects like this. Planning boards, special permits are not needed. The Conservation Commission has to approve tree removal and stormwater drainage plans, which have already happened. River Mill Storage will be one of the largest BESS developments in the state. A project in the Everett just came online and provides 700 megawatts and is thus far the largest facility. River Mill and the three other projects were accepted under the terms of a competitive procurement program run by the state's electric distribution companies and the Department of Energy Resources. More projects will be selected in the coming months. And in public health, West Nile virus found in mosquitoes in Billerica and Fitchburg by Peter Currier of The Sun. Mosquitoes with West Nile virus were found in Billerica and Fitchburg last week as the number of possible mosquito samples rises to 43 so far in 2026. There are no confirmed human or animal cases, according to the State Department of Public Health. West Nile virus is primarily transmitted to humans via the bite of a mosquito. The illness carries a range of symptoms, including fever, headaches, joint pain, vomiting, diarrhea, and rash in some milder cases, according to the U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention. In more severe cases, where the virus impacts the central nervous system, it can cause encephalitis, which is inflammation of the brain, and meningitis, which is inflammation of the membranes around the brain and spinal cord. Excuse me. Symptoms in more severe West Nile cases include high fever, headache, stiffness of the neck, stupor, disorientation, coma, tremor, convulsions, muscle weakness, vision loss, numbness, and paralysis, according to the CDC, which also says about 10% of patients with a central nervous system infection die. The mosquitoes that carry this virus are common throughout the state and are found in urban as well as rural areas. While West Nile virus can infect people of all ages, people over the age of 50 are at higher risk for severe infection, the town of Billerica said in a statement on its website and social media Tuesday evening. The town offered advice for avoiding mosquito bites altogether, including use of insect repellent when outdoors, wearing pants and long-sleeved shirts, staying inside during peak mosquito hours at dusk and dawn. The town also advised residents to drain standing water outdoors where mosquitoes readily breed and to install and repair window screens. While Billerica Board of Health continues to work closely with the MDPH and other agencies locally, are working with Central Mass Mosquito Control Project to control mosquitoes in Billerica, said the town's statement. In response, the Central Mass Mosquito Control Project will continue to treat catch basins in Billerica that require treatment for larval control. The CMMCP, or Central Mass Mosquito Control Project, will also conduct a mosquito control spray application next week in the affected area. Notice regarding the upcoming mosquito control spray application will be posted on the Town of Billerica website prior to the application. According to the DPH, risk map for West Nile virus, the risk in Billerica still remains low, and just one positive mosquito sample was found on July 22nd, along with samples in Stoneham and Woburn. So far this year, there have been no reported human or animal cases of West Nile virus or of Eastern equine encephalitis, another commonly tracked mosquito-borne illness. There have also been no reported EEE-positive mosquito samples in the state so far this year. West Nile virus was discovered in a mosquito sample in Fitchburg on July 21st, along with samples in Boston, Barnstable, Falmouth, Northfield, and Whitman. Another positive mosquito sample was found in Worcester on July 24th. The highest current risk for the virus is found in and around the cities of Boston and Worcester, where the DPH map shows pockets of cities and towns with a moderate risk. And some shorts. Governor Healey visits the LYLP. Governor Healey made a surprise visit to the Lowell Youth Leadership Program Summer Camp Friday, July 24th. She spoke with campers about the importance of civic engagement, signed t-shirts and hats, and threw a football with some campers. The visit was initiated by State Senator Vanna Howard. LYLP provides a free summer camp for 180 Lowell youth ages 10 to 16. It includes free transportation to and from the camp, breakfast and lunch, and over 33 different activities, including swim lessons. Tewksbury Community Market still going on. Bring an appetite for food and adventure for the Tewksbury Community Market on Thursday, July 30th from 4 to 7 in the parking lot behind the Recreation Center at 288 Livingston Street. The market runs every Thursday through the end of September. More than 30 vendors will be on hand offering farm fresh vegetables, fresh baked desserts, cold pressed juice, as well as other food choices such as mac and cheese, seafood, and barbecue. Or browse the creations made by local artisans and crafters. Food trucks serving Kona ice, lemonade, egg rolls, Mexican food, and the Whoopie Wagon will also be on site. The market's lineup changes weekly with up to 30 vendors featured each week. There are 5 parking lots near the market, including across the street near the football fields and next to the playground. A limited number of marked handicapped parking spots are located in a small parking lot in the front of the recreation center. Most vendors accept both cash and credit. For information, visit TewksburyMarket.com. GLCF Nonprofit Survey. The Greater Lowell Community Foundation is committed to understanding the full funding landscape facing nonprofit community. Building on prior federal funding impact surveys, this survey looks more broadly at how federal, state, and private funding sources are shifting. Nonprofit input directly shapes GLCF's funding decisions. Responses to GLCF's prior surveys help guide real allocations, including more than $1 million of response grants as a direct result of the critical data nonprofit partners shared. This survey will inform where GLCF directs resources next. The survey should take about 10 minutes to complete. Participation is voluntary and responses will be kept confidential. Aggregate findings may be shared to advocate for community needs and guide future Greater Lowell Community Foundation initiatives. Save the date. Middlesex County 4-H Fair. This year's Middlesex County 4-H Fair takes place Friday, August 28th and Saturday, August 29th from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. and Sunday, August 30th from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the 4-H Fairgrounds, 655 Chelmsford Road. Attendees get a glimpse, page 4, into New England's long history of agriculture and art through the work event of Middlesex County youth enrolled in 4-H. All fair exhibitors are members of 4-H clubs in Middlesex County as well as surrounding counties. And the fair is operated exclusively by 4-H volunteers. Animal exhibits include horses, cows, sheep, goats, cats, dogs, pigs, rabbits, and chickens. Fair also includes exhibits presenting arts and crafts, photography, cooking, and garden, and more. Family-friendly all-ages event includes hay and pony rides, rabbit races, and face painting. Animal exhibits and shows and an old-time contest such as corn husking and watermelon eating. Fair food favorites include chicken barbecue, penny candy, and ice cream. Artists and vendors and specialty food trucks will also be on site. And what else do we have here? On page 6, we find today in history. In 1619, the first representative assembly in colonial America convened in Jamestown in the Virginia colony, the House of Burgesses. Same year, the first Africans were imported as indentured servants or slaves, enslaved people. In 1864, during the Civil War, Union forces tried to take Petersburg, Virginia by exploding a gunpowder-laden mine shaft beneath Confederate defense lines. The attack failed. In 1916, German saboteurs blew up a munitions plant on Black Tom, an island near Jersey City, New Jersey, killing about a dozen people. In 1945, the heavy cruiser USS Indianapolis, having just delivered components of the atomic bomb to Tinian in the Mariana Islands during World War II, was torpedoed by a Japanese submarine. Only 316 out of the nearly 1,200 service members survived. The rescue was delayed because of the secrecy of the mission. Many of those who died from shark attacks. 1956, President Dwight Eisenhower signed a measure making "In God We Trust" the national motto, replacing "E Pluribus Union," Unum, also adding "in God, under God" to the Pledge of Allegiance. In 1965, President Lyndon Johnson signed the Social Security Amendment in 1965, which led to the creation of Medicare and Medicaid. 1976, Bruce Jenner, now known as Caitlyn Jenner, set a world record of 8,618 points and won the gold medal in the Olympic decathlon at the Montreal Summer Games. In 2012, three electric grids in India collapsed in a cascade, blocking power to 620 million people in the world's biggest blackout. 2013, U.S. Army Private First Class Chelsea Manning was acquitted of aiding the enemy, most serious charge she faced, but was convicted of espionage, theft, and other charges at Fort Meade, Maryland, more than 3 years after she'd spilled secrets to WikiLeaks. 2016, 16 people died when a hot air balloon caught fire and exploded after hitting high-tension power lines before crashing into a pasture near Lockhart, Texas, northeast of San Antonio. On the opinion page, we have a piece by Safe Savage, Massachusetts AI Balancing Act. Dr. Safe Savage is an assistant professor at Northeastern University's Corey Center of Computer Science and director of Northeastern Civic AI Lab. An internationally recognized AI researcher, she advises policymakers on artificial intelligence, the future of work, and technology's impact on society. And again, this is by Safe Savage. Massachusetts lawmakers are putting the finishing touches on a major economic development bill called Mass Wins. The bill sets aside substantial funding to support the growth of the Commonwealth's artificial intelligence industry, which Governor Maura Healey has long touted. But as swiftly as legislature is investing in innovation, it may be hitting the brakes too quickly with onerous regulations. Experts across industries agree that this new frontier needs a certain level of governance and transparency to protect consumers, employees, and the public good. But these efforts should be put in perspective with the breakthrough advances made possible by artificial intelligence. From accelerated drug discovery to improved energy grid efficiency to precision agriculture, the potential applications are vast, as are the benefits, particularly for states on the cutting edge of AI innovation. As we work together to approach artificial intelligence and its myriad uses, let us take care not to hamstring an industry as it continues to grow. Yet as the House and Senate debate over the right approach, I worry that might be exactly what happens. In their initial proposals, the Senate and House approached the regulation of artificial intelligence differently. While both focus on large frontier AI models, how they seek to keep the companies behind them in line differ. Both proposals would require companies building powerful AI to publish their safety frameworks, explaining how they prevent and respond to risks. Catastrophic risks, including significant hacking breaches, would be singled out for transparency and reporting, and showing that transparency is a priority for lawmakers as they work towards a solution that supports innovation while protecting consumers. But oversight is where lawmakers have diverged. While the House pushed forward a bill that followed the path of Illinois, which recently signed into law the strictest AI safety legislation in the country, requiring third-party auditing, it later pulled it, recognizing the impact it could have on the blossoming innovation community in the state. In recent weeks, the Senate has since concluded with the approach by suggesting the state create a government commission to study AI safety regulations, including the potential use of auditors. While it may sound like a small distinction, Getting it right is important. As we take on the regulation of frontier AI models, the Anthropic-favored approach of using third-party auditors would require further industry regulation to ensure auditors are qualified and have the necessary expertise. Currently, there are no government-set standards governing third-party auditors and their processes. An industry like artificial intelligence requires more than an honor system of self-policing given its expansive impacts globally. Transparency and governance are important. In our world of ever-changing technology, keeping up with the latest development is a challenge in itself. Managing a patchwork of state laws risks making things worse. Technology often moves faster than the government, and we should ensure that the regulatory system we use adapts to these changes and allows our most innovative creators to continue experimenting and growing the technology. The goal is a regulatory system that provides transparency and ensures public and consumer safety while keeping pace with the industry. There is a balance to be met between responsible government regulation and a thriving innovative sector. Massachusetts lawmakers must find that line to build public trust for the industry as it continues to grow into a state-level hub of technology. Okay. The other editorial is Lottery celebrates as it launches bold gamble on future. Once again, Massachusetts State Lottery has proven to be the ultimate cash cow for the Commonwealth cities and towns. Officials announced this week that for the sixth consecutive fiscal year, the state lottery has cracked the magic number, generating a staggering estimated $1.05 billion in net profit for fiscal 2026. Reaching this milestone was no simple feat. The agency navigated a declining 3.7 dip in traditional scratch ticket sales and a record-breaking 74.19% player payout rate, the highest in lottery's 50-plus years. For communities across the state, this lottery take isn't just a line item in a ledger. It represents a critical, unrestricted local aid that funds our schools, fixes our pothole-ridden roads, and keeps police officers and firefighters on our streets. In an era where local budgets are stretched to the breaking point by overall inflation and rising fixed costs, the lottery remains an indispensable lifeline. State Treasurer Deb Goldberg, Lottery Executive Director Mark William Bracken, and thousands of brick-and-mortar retailers across the Merrimack Valley and Twin Cities deserve a hearty round of applause for keeping the engine humming. But as any savvy business owner knows, you cannot rest on your laurels, especially when your core product, the paper scratch ticket, faces a shifting demographic. That's why the biggest news out of the lottery this week isn't just billion-dollar profit milestone. It's the long-awaited historic launch of Massachusetts Lottery's online gaming offerings. On Monday, the lottery officially leapt into the 21st century with its digital platform, allowing the Massachusetts residents aged 21 and older to wager on draw games and new e-instant digital scratch tickets right from their smartphones and computers. This move wasn't taken lightly. It's viewed as an absolute necessity for the continued viability of this indispensable state moneymaker. For years, the lottery has been figuratively fighting in this legalized gambling landscape with one hand tied behind its back. While the state rapidly legalized resort casinos and mobile sports betting apps like DraftKings and FanDuel, the lottery was left stranded in an all-cash, in-person world. Its growth had plateaued, and adjusting for inflation, its actual purchasing power peaked nearly a quarter century ago. To remain relevant to the younger consumer who rarely carry cash, let alone step up to a convenience store counter to buy a physical ticket, going digital represented the logical next step. The primary funding goal of this digital expansion represents a departure from that of the legacy lottery. While traditional profits will continue to anchor local aid, The new revenue generated from online sales has been earmarked to fund a grant program to support early childhood education and care across the state, making child care more affordable for low-income working-class families in gateway cities like Lowell and Fitchburg could allow those who depend on state subsidies to gain a measure of economic independence. But the path to realizing this noble objective necessitates walking a fine line between past and future. First and foremost is the challenge of protecting the state's massive network of small business retailers. Mom-and-pop convenience stores, gas stations, and bodegas rely heavily on foot traffic that lottery players constitute. When someone stops in to buy a scratch ticket, they often pick up a gallon of milk, a sandwich, or a cup of coffee. With that dynamic in mind, the lottery has wisely designed safeguards, such as keeping traditional keno and certain popular draw games exclusively at retail locations in order to ensure our local storefronts can maintain their client base. Keeping those small business owners whole must remain a top priority as the online app grows in popularity. The second and no less critical challenge centers around addressing the social costs of gambling. By bringing lottery directly into smartphones and other digital devices, the state has effectively put a digital casino into the hands of countless potential players. Advocacy groups have rightfully warned that e-instant games, which feature fast-paced tumbling symbols, resemble slot machines, carry a higher risk of fueling gambling addiction than traditional paper tickets. The lottery has rolled out responsible gambling features, including strict daily deposit limits, mandatory in-game timers, and self-exclusion mechanisms. However, the state must closely monitor the real-world impact of these games. Revenue for early childhood education cannot come at the expense of devastating vulnerable families through unchecked problem gambling. The Massachusetts State Lottery has built a 50-year legacy of unmatched success, returning over $35 billion in net profit to local communities since 1972. This week's doubleheader of a $1.04 $5 billion profit announcement and the launch of the online platform represents both a celebration of that legacy and a bold gamble on the future. As the digital era begins, lottery officials must balance the pursuit of new revenue with the protection of our local retail corridors and the health of our residents. They can successfully walk that tightrope. The Commonwealth might just hit the jackpot for years to come. All right, let's see. Are there any local sports stories? I'm not sure there are. But there is a couple articles here. States move to limit classroom screen time. That's interesting. This is by Robbie Sequeira from stateline.org. After school cell phone bans passed many state houses with bipartisan support in recent legislative sessions, state lawmakers are turning to legislation governing how long students should spend looking at screens. This year, four states regulating laws restricting or regulating screen time for students from child care through fifth grade. Iowa capped digital instruction at 60 minutes per day for students in kindergarten through fifth grade, with exceptions for special ed assessments and computer science. Utah lawmakers this year directed state education board to develop grade-specific technology rules, including restrictions on screen time in kindergarten through third grade and prohibiting one device per student ratio in elementary school. But a new Tennessee law requires every district and charter school serving K-5 students to adopt an age-appropriate digital device policy to minimize unnecessary screen time. And Alabama this year adopted a law requiring the establishment of screen time standards and teacher training for child care facilities, kindergarten, and pre-kindergarten. But a Missouri bill to require school districts and charter schools to adopt screen time policies for kindergarten through fifth grade, and an Oklahoma proposal to cap screen time at 60 minutes per day for students in kindergarten through fifth grade, both failed. The Missouri bill easily cleared the House but stalled in the Senate. Despite passing the Oklahoma House unanimously, that bill stalled in the Senate and faced pushback from a technology industry trading group. Yeah, right. The Software and Information Industry Association referred to the bill as an unfundable mandate and said it would increase administrative burdens and undermine workforce readiness. Some school districts also are adopting screen time. I'm sorry, I'm not sure. I'm just looking back at that, I'm not sure how much of K through 5 education should be about workforce readiness. Some school districts also are adopting screen time policies for the upcoming school year. The Los Angeles Unified School District, the nation's second largest school district, is the one of the first to impose system-wide grade-by-grade instructional screen limits. Los Angeles has barred instructional screen time before second grade. The district also set limits that increase incrementally to 60 minutes per subject per week for middle school students and 90 minutes per subject per week for high school students. Inanna Balkin, a rising high school senior at Amherst Regional High School in Massachusetts, told Stateline that it's really important for students to learn how to manage their screen time and that schools should help students develop habits for managing screen time rather than simply removing access to technology. Automatically not having access to your phone or a screen during the day kind of doesn't allow for students to be responsible for their own management when school is over, said Balkin, who uses an app called Opal to block distractions while doing homework. There are no clear national statistics measuring how many minutes students spend using screens for classroom instruction, yet screen time has become a focus of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services under Secretary Robert F. Kennedy, including a warning from the Surgeon General's office. Tracy Weeks, Senior Director of Education Policy and Strategy at education technology company Infrastructure, told Stateline that states should consider metrics other than minutes when proposing screen time policies. The policy's focus has been on minutes, and that's the wrong conversation to be having because not all minutes are created equal. We said scrolling for 10 minutes is not the same as actually interacting with the tool for learning. Virginia now requires public schools to provide instruction about time spent using electronic devices and their addictive potential. Maine is directing the Maine Education Policy Research Institute to study classroom technology use, including average instructional time on state-issued devices and existing safeguards. And an environment article from the Maine Monitor, Delger Erdenesana. NOAA report finds warming in Gulf of Maine has slowed for now. Maine's fishing ports are doing well for now, but climate change is destabilizing the Gulf of Maine, according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's latest State of the Ecosystem report for New England Waters. Federal scientists presented the report to the New England Fishery Management Council in April and published it online last week. They found that some Maine fishing ports are growing busier, likely driven by the high price of lobster. Stonington, Harpswell, and Friendship all see more activity now than they did roughly 20 years ago. And 2025, like 2024, offered slightly cooler water temperatures after more than a decade of rapid and record-breaking warming in the Gulf of Maine. But scientists predict that temperatures will warm again this fall and will continue to rise long term as the burning of fossil fuels releases greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. To weather these ongoing changes, fishermen in their communities need to diversify their businesses, experts say. Things don't look particularly stable either in terms of the fishery or the ecosystem, said Joseph Caracappa, research biologist at NOAA's Northeast Fisheries Fisheries Science Center, who edited the report. We're seeing big changes that are sweeping across ecology of the systems and fisheries. Even socially, culturally, how communities are structured, where people are fishing, who's actually doing the fishing. This annual report includes contributions from more than 100 scientists across the Northeast. NOAA has had to make do with fewer resources as the federal government priorities have changed under the second Trump administration. But otherwise, the report has been prepared and published as usual, COPPA said. And in fact, this latest report debuted a new section dedicated to forecasting ocean conditions in the year ahead. That could help the report's intended audience of fisheries managers navigate an uncertain future, said Michelle Bachman, a senior fishery analyst at the New England Fishery Management Council, which gives federal officials recommended management plans for fisheries in the region's federal waters. Bachman said that when she began work at the council in 2008, she and her colleagues did not talk about climate change. That's now changed in part thanks to these reports from NOAA, which have been published annually for about 10 years. Everything is changing and in ways that we don't totally understand, she said, and we need to be ready to respond to a dynamic system as opposed to acting like we're managing something that's static. That volatility is apparent in the ocean's temperatures off Maine's coast. Around 2012, the region suffered a major marine heat wave. 2015, researchers published a now famous study showing that the Gulf of Maine was warming faster than 99% of the ocean. But since around 2021, those temperatures have cooled down somewhat. The Gulf of Maine is still warmer than it was historically, but compared to the most recent very warm years, now is kind of a nice reprieve for marine species that prefer cooler water, Bachman said. Scientists attribute these temperature swings in large part to the competing influences of the warm Gulf Stream ocean current coming from the south and the Labrador current coming from the north. Over the past 2 years, Gulf Stream has had less of an influence on New England waters, but it appears to be coming back, according to the State of Ecosystem report. Temperature changes are scrambling where different species live. Warming temperatures have contributed to the decline of cod in this region. The 2012 marine heat wave led to the collapse of the northern shrimp fishery. Southern New England has largely lost its lobsters, while Maine gained more until very recently. Across New England as a whole, commercial fisheries have consolidated mostly into lobster and scallop. Both have high climate vulnerability risks, said Caracapas. You're really at the whim of an environment on whether or not you can sustain that. So things might be good as long as conditions hold out. Scientists expect the lobster population, even in Maine waters, to decline from now on. But that doesn't mean the fishery will be lost entirely, said Catherine Mills, a senior scientist at the Gulf of Maine Research Institute. Mills was not involved in NOAA's State of the Ecosystem report, but studies similar topics. I don't want to present false hope about the future of the fishery, but I don't want to present false hope about the future of the fishery, but I also don't want to convey that it's about to collapse, because I think that it's not in either of those situations. We should have a lobster resource that continues to sustain a fishery here in Maine, but we may have to adjust to a lower volume. And that's all we have in the Lowell Sun. From the Lawrence Eagle Tribune, we have learning. This is the Eagle Tribune. Front page, learning leadership, sheriff's camp blends summer fun with skills to make the right choices. This is by Jill Harmon-Sinke in Middleton. Campers go bowling to a trampoline party, play mini golf, and enjoy Richardson's ice cream. They also work on criminal investigations, train similarly to firefighters, and learn life-saving skills. Some 600 kids are back again this summer for Sheriff Kevin Coppinger's Youth Leadership Academy, which explores the dangers of drugs, gangs, and bullying, while conversely reinforcing how good decision-making, respect, and leadership ensures a bright future. Youth campers from age 8 to 14 from different parts of Essex County are welcomed each week. Campers are divided into junior and senior groups for activities and discussions that are tailored to different age levels. This week, the campers are from Lawrence, Methuen, Andover, Haverhill, and Danvers. Preventing problems before they even start is the heart of the academy. The best way to keep young people away from drugs, violence, and bullying and other harmful behaviors is to reach them before they ever face those challenges, Coppinger explained. He said the Leadership Academy gives kids the confidence to make good decisions, stand up to others, become positive leaders in the schools and communities. If even one child leaves here more confident, more compassionate, and better prepared to make the right choices, we've accomplished something meaningful. When that happens, hundreds of times over the course of the summer, it makes a real difference in the future of Essex County. Throughout the week, campers participate in hands-on activities, educational presentations, team-building exercises, and go on field trips that encourage confidence, responsibility, and cooperation. Interactive lessons teach practical life skills, including internet safety, CPR, bullying prevention, substance use awareness, and how to make positive choices that can positively impact themselves, their families, and their communities. The Academy also gives campers the opportunity to meet correctional officers, law enforcement professionals, first responders, community partners who introduce them to careers in public safety while reinforcing the importance of teamwork, respect, and service to others. Methuen police detectives led an interactive criminal investigation class, while the Middleton Fire Department teaches fire safety. The Middleton Fire Police Department discusses personal safety and the dangers of strangers. Massachusetts State Police also gave a presentation on safety. Senior campers also tour Milton Jail, giving them a first-hand look at the consequences of poor decisions while reinforcing the importance of making positive choices. Campers also enjoy all kinds of activities, including bowling, mini golf, a trampoline park, a whale watch excursion, a visit from curious creatures, and other activities. These activities foster friendships, build teamwork, and create lasting memories, Coppinger said. Free for kids, the Leadership Academy is paid for in part from funding from the New England High Intensity Drug Trafficking Area, a federal agency based in Methuen. Essex County Outreach also offsets costs. Mackenzie O'Rourke, 9, and Rihanna Sood, 9, both in Methuen, were excited to come back after attending last year. Everyone should go. It's fun and you learn a lot, O'Rourke said. This was the first year attending for Bennett Allison, 8, and Ryan Schwartz, 8, both at Danvers. They have already discovered why so many children return, though. Allison said one of the most valuable lessons he's learned is CPR. That could help somebody, Allison said. Schwartz agreed. Everyone should go to cop camp, he said. The Academy's impact extends beyond its campers. Alexandria Boucher of Salem, who attended the program every summer from ages 8 to 14, has returned this year as a counselor while studying criminal justice as a senior at St. Anselm College. I can be the role model like the counselors were to me, Boucher said. They're learning a lot while still having fun. Interest in the Academy continues to grow every year. Registration opens each March at eccf.com, and the nearly 600 available spots are typically filled within just a few hours. Coppinger said he hears from parents every year about the lasting impact the program has on their family. We've had families tell us that their child was able to help someone who was choking because they remembered the CPR training they received at the Academy. Others have shared stories about their children recognizing when a classmate was being bullied and having the confidence to step up, speak up, or get an adult involved. Those are the moments that remind us that this program is much more than a week of summer camp. It's about giving young people the skills and confidence to make a positive difference wherever they go, he said. As sheriff, I spend a great deal of time helping adults rebuild lives after poor decisions. Programs like this allow us to work on the other end of the equation by giving young people the knowledge, confidence, and character to make positive choices from the very beginning. It's one of the best investments we can make in the future of our communities. And from Haverhill, no confidence letters, details, unrest. This is by Jonah Frangiosa. Newly released, no confidence letters offer the clearest picture yet of the turmoil inside the Haverhill Police Department following the deaths of resident Francis Gigliotti and police officer Caitlin Tully. Three police unions issued votes of no confidence in the former chief Robert Pistone and deputy chief Stephen Doherty, accusing the department leadership of fostering culture that damaged officer morale and trust and failed to support employees during a troubling period marked by twin tragedies last year. On Tuesday, the city of Haverhill released the letters submitted by the Haverhill Police Patrolmen's Association, the Haverhill Police Superior and Executive Officers Union, and the New England Benevolent Association, Incorporated, which represents the local police dispatcher union. Mayor Melinda Barrett placed Pistone and Doherty on administrative leave following the union's votes of no confidence. Pistone retired shortly thereafter, while Doherty later submitted an irrevocable resignation that will take place March 27th. He will be considered to have retired in good standing. In their letter, Patrolmen's Union announced their vote in both the former chief and deputy chief, alleging a lack of transparency, poor communication, and a failure to support officers. The union said rank and file officers have become increasingly frustrated with leadership, who they believed was dismissive of their concerns. The HPPA remains steadfast in our commitment to serving the residents of Haverhill with integrity, professionalism, and dedication, the letter reads. However, we can no longer remain silent as the concerns of those on the front lines goes unaddressed. Much of the disapproval came in after the July 11th, 2025 incident involving Gigliotti, 43, who was taken into custody after officers responded to reports of a man acting erratically. Gigliotti became unresponsive while being restrained by officers, was taken to a hospital, and later died. Seven officers were placed on administrative leave while authorities investigated the incident. On September 26, Tully, one of the officers placed on leave, died unexpectedly at her home, sending a shockwave through the community and department. Our unwavering commitment ensures Tully's memory lives on through our purposeful action and service, the HPPA's letter continues. Every task we undertake is a reflection of the strength and spirit Caitlin Tully embodied. United by purpose, we strive each day to turn this loss into her lasting legacy. The Haverhill Police Superior and Executive Officer Union separately issued a vote of no confidence in Doherty, alleging he aligned himself with Pistone's in practices that undermine trust, morale, and the department's operational effectiveness. According to the letter, Doherty reinforced what the union described as Pistone's retaliatory actions against officers, including punitive reassignments, threats of discipline, and enforcement of politically influenced directives. By failing to act independently and by aligning with the questionable practices, Deputy Chief Doherty has contributed to the toxic, demoralizing environment in the department, he said. The union stated, Haverhill's Police Dispatcher Union Local Number 119 also voted no confidence in Pistone and Doherty, focusing largely on their handling of the aftermath of Gigliotti and Tugley's deaths. The dispatchers said that following the July incident, neither the chief nor deputy chief explained what the department's process would be moving forward. Dispatchers answered calls from the public who consistently threatened the department and directed profanity toward the officers almost daily, while the seven officers involved in the incident remained on administrative leave. The way they have left, the seven, now six, officers blowing in the wind takes a negative toll on the whole department and their families, their letter reads. Pistone and Doherty also failed to check on dispatch personnel after Tully's death, according to the letter, including one dispatcher who and answer the 911 call reporting their co-worker's death in September. The department leaders allegedly did not visit dispatch, offering counseling resources or ask the health and wellness director to check on employees. In January, the law office of Timothy J. Bradle, representing Gigliotti's family and estate, served the city of Haverhill with a formal notice of claim before filing a civil lawsuit against the city. The notice alleges officers and first responders restrained Gigliotti face down with body weight applied for an extended period, preventing him from breathing and causing his death. The family has announced its intent to pursue civil litigation independent of the district attorney's criminal investigation and the medical examiner's homicide determination. Also released Tuesday was an independent investigation that found Pistone engaged in dishonest and unprofessional conduct by falsely attributing leadership decisions to the mayor. The report also concludes that Doherty frequently used derogatory and demeaning language towards patrol officers. Investigators decide, however, that allegations Pistone and Doherty failed to Investigators decided, however, that allegations Pistone and Doherty failed to adequately support the officers reflected leadership and judgment issues rather than violent violations of policy. In Salem, New Hampshire, this is by Teddy Tauscher, shift in market responsible for changes at Tuscan Village. A glut in life science buildings at Tuscan Village has been cited as a reason for the developer to pivot to constructing more housing in the next phase of the multi-million dollar development. Residents and planning members had an opportunity Tuesday to comment and ask questions about a plan to build two more apartment complexes with over 450 units, a hotel, and other buildings in the new West Village District. The proposal concerned some resident and board members expressed their discontent with proposed changes, particularly a move from building condominiums to rental units. Tuscan Village attorney Mark Gross said the new plan would increase impact fees paid to the town from $1.3 to $3.7 million and boost net revenue from about $80,000 to $800,000 on the municipal side. Tuscan has estimated that new district would result in $2.7 million in tax revenue for local education, which is unchanged from the estimates for the life science district plan. During the meeting's public comment section, resident Warren Morrison said the town should not look at revenue as the only factor in approving projects. "We can't be blinded by the dollars," Morrison said. "Do we really want every square inch of this site developed?" He said residents are looking for development to offer more recreational opportunities for adults. He spoke of a playground touted by Tuscan. "I can't play on the monkey bars there," Morrison said. But under the new plan, 133 condominium units would be replaced by a 392-unit apartment complex and a 50-unit workforce apartment building has been increased to 72 units. Proposal for a hotel has been reduced by 30 rooms to 120. The district would also include some office space, a bank, and a restaurant. An earlier plan for the life science district was scrapped before the presentation of the current proposal. The bigger emphasis on housing is a reflection of a market where there is generally less demand for life science campuses, medical buildings, and workspaces, Guru said. "The medical industry is not a good place right now," Gross said, partly in reference to the bankruptcy of Steward Healthcare. Tuscan Village has also yet to fill all of its available retail spaces. "Meanwhile, the state still does not have enough housing," he said. "There is still some need for smaller office spaces," Gross said. He said they were unable to find a bank to finance the previously proposed condo project. Gross gave a similar explanation for why affordable and market-priced apartments were separated into two buildings. Board member Chuck Saban said he would prefer that the affordable apartments be mixed in with regular costs so it would not be public knowledge who is paying the lower rate. I understand it's difficult, but it's also significantly better planned because it doesn't pinpoint specific people, Saba said. Due to a local ordinance, high-density housing projects need to include at least 10% affordable units. Gross said workforce housing has to be built more cheaply than market-rate apartments, or else there would be no financial incentives to provide the projects. It is a totally different construction, Gross said. An affordable housing project needs to project exceeds a developer's obligation to build workforce housing, meaning Tuscan Village could add more market rate units elsewhere without worrying about affordability requirements. The new proposal is expected to require less water than previously approved life science district. Officials are conducting independent financial and water usage analysis of the project, among other reviews. A New Hampshire Department of Transportation traffic analysis of the West Village District proposal found the projected volumes to be acceptable, according to the state agency. The project was continued to a future board meeting. If approved, the district would include 1,733 parking spaces and 880,000 square feet. Since the design is in the conceptual stage, architectural decisions are still subject to change, according to Goss. Under the proposal, the total number of residential units in Tuscan Village would increase to 1,975. Of those units, only about 8% are for sale, according to calculations by town officials. The first master plan presented by Tuscan Village in 2018 called for only 350 residential units alongside 165 units of assisted living housing and a 55-plus duplex development. Those plans were significantly affected by the COVID-19 pandemic, according to Goss. It's quite a development up there. And the last article on page one from North Andover, it opens. Teen organizes concert for Alzheimer's awareness. This is by Angelina Barub and it's out of North Andover. A Boxford teenager seeks to raise awareness for Alzheimer's and raise funds to research the disease with a charity concert event next month. The third annual Melodies of Hope concert takes place from 4 p.m. to 7:30 p.m. August 23rd on the North Andover Town Common. Three bands will perform during the evening. Donations will be accepted at the family-friendly concert for the Alzheimer's Association. There is no fee to attend and listen to the show. Event organizer Colby Young, 17, said the goal is to raise $7,500 this year. Young established the concert a few years ago as a way to raise awareness and support for the Alzheimer's Association as a disease has affected his family. Young's grandmother, Patricia, had Alzheimer's, and he said his family is still affected by its diagnosis and loved ones. Alzheimer's is a progressive brain disease that causes problems with memory, thinking, and behavior. It is the most common cause of dementia, according to the Alzheimer's Association. Now, unfortunately, I have some other family members that are dealing with Alzheimer's, so it's added some more meaning to the concert, Young said. His parents, Dina and Stuart Young, said they are proud of their son for taking a personal experience with loss and turning it into something positive for the community to raise awareness and funds for Alzheimer's research. His grandmother suffered with the disease for 7 years. She moved in with his family when he was 5, and each family member helped take care of her in his own way. Young remembered hanging out with her and listening to music together like Elvis Presley tunes until she died in 2021. What started this, Young recalled, calling his relationship with her, saying that his relationship with her inspired the concert. He came up with the idea for the show shortly after she died. Young's mother, Deanna, said her mother loved her two grandsons more than anything and spent time listening to music with Colby. She recalled her mother having a boombox in her room and humming along to her favorite songs when the time came. She could no longer remember family's names. She said her son has found a way to connect his time enjoying music with his grandmother to bring awareness to the disease that devastated her family, but to advance research on it for other families grappling with it. My mom's passing was very difficult on all of us, she said. I think getting involved with Alzheimer's Association and organizing Melodies of Hope helped Colby as he worked through his grief. Jung began playing a guitar after his grandmother's passing and has played for 5 years. She never got to hear him perform. He said it's one of his biggest regrets. I would have loved for her to hear me play while she was with us, he said. Jung is also a committee member for the Alzheimer's Association's local chapter of the Walked End Alzheimer's. Over the last year, he's advocated at the Massachusetts State House for bills related to Alzheimer's. There's a lot being done in the state, Jung said. I'm hoping we can help it. The teenager will continue his fundraising efforts for Alzheimer's Association with a comedy show on October 17th at the North Andover Veterans of Foreign War Post ahead of the Walked End Alzheimer's. From the State House, this is an article by Christian Wade. Mass GOP blasts its own candidate over fraud claims. State Republican Party is criticizing one of its own gubernatorial hopefuls for accusing another GOP candidate for governor of contributing to voter fraud. Republican Brian Shortsleeve, a venture capitalist and former MBTA head running for governor, rolled out his first TV political ads on Wednesday attacking his GOP rival Mike Minogue for defending while calling for a voter ID requirement to cast ballots in federal, state, and local elections. Minogue, a former biotech executive, won the state's Republican Party's endorsement with a landslide win at GOP's convention in Worcester in April, picking up 70% of votes from about 1,800 party delegates. While Minogue hasn't renamed a running mate for lieutenant governor, governor, Shortsleeve's campaign is trying to time to former Republican lieutenant governor candidate Ann Manning Martin, who failed to qualify for the ballot after claiming she was duped by a fraudster paid to collect signatures from voters. While Mike Minogue's preferred running mate committed election fraud, he endorsed it, Shortsleeve said in his 30-second ad, defending the political insiders, attacking those who exposed it. Now he wants you to trust him to lead Massachusetts. But GOP chairwoman Amy Carnevale lashed out at Shortsleeve for making the accusations. As chair of the party, it's my responsibility to stand up for and support Republican candidates, particularly when they are being unfairly attacked, misrepresented, or wronged, Carnevale said in a prepared statement. In this case, fraud was perpetrated against our candidates. Carnevale called Shortsleeve's attempt to exploit that fraud for political advantage while portraying himself as a champion of election integrity and disparaging fellow Republicans is both misleading and deeply disappointing. This kind of conduct does a disservice to the candidates, the Republican Party, and the voters whose trust we are working to earn, she said. The Minogue campaign didn't immediately respond Wednesday to a request for comment. Shortsleeve, a venture capitalist and former MBTA official, also secured a spot on the ballot with 16% of the vote at the party's convention. He previously qualified for the ballot by submitting the required number of signatures. He has tapped Lieutenant Governor candidate Sean Oliver as his running mate. In a statement highlighting Shortsleeve's voter ID ad, his campaign spokesperson Pat Nestor doubled down on the claims against Minogue. Mike Minogue had a choice. He could have stood with voters and condemned election fraud, or he could stand with the political insiders responsible for it. He chose the insiders, Nestor said in a written statement. Even after the Massachusetts Republican Party acknowledged fraud and condemned it, Mike Minogue refused to do the same despite ruling finding substantial, if not overwhelming, evidence of fraud, Nestor added. The winner of the GOP primary will face incumbent Governor Maura Healey, a first-term Democrat, in the November 3rd election. Healey, who is seeking another four-year term, isn't facing a primary challenger. From the opinion and editorial page, Lawrence Eagle Tribune, we first have a letter to the editor by Joe DeMore, who writes a weekly column, The Outward View, for the North of Boston Media Group. He leads contemplative hikes in AMC for the AMC in the White Mountains in Cape Cod National Seashore. This happens often on an exposed ridgeline. There, in the perilous space of unclaimed earth between summit and a line of forest trees, I witness a solitary flower. Wild, tenacious, seemingly vulnerable, yet firmly rooted and resolute. Suddenly, there is a cascading wind combing the mountain face, offering a familiar rush, a whisper of assurance, and an expression of love. It reminds me of my granddaughter. Utterly spent after explosive joyous childish play, she collapses. Held in my embrace, she descends into a deep yet brief slumber. She is secure while delicately suspended in enveloping loving arms. And then I hear, distant and detectable, the air expelled from her little pink lungs, a sigh of comfort. Soft sound from her little mouth is a familiar one. Poignantly, it emits a familiar smell, too delightfully reminiscent of baby blankets she came home with. I revel in the vapor when I place my cheek next to hers. Her breath emits the same warmth and soothing rustle I experience on the ridge. The sweetness of her presence is there in my sight, the solitary flower nestled in soft blanket of subalpine fauna. And another letter to the editor by Dina Mayer of Londonderry. Water conservation is everybody's responsibility. Water, water everywhere, but not in a way it is helping our lakes, streams, rivers, and wells. Times have changed. We are a more populated society. Where there is land, contractors are cutting down trees, filling in wetlands, getting variances to build multi-homes and condos. Affordable, it seems, without concerns about how neighbors, cities, towns, communities are affected. We have to be better stewards. Simply turn off the water when brushing teeth. Take shorter showers. Wash clothes once or twice a week instead of daily. Water lawns and gardens according to local ordinances, not in the heat of the day. Contact your town if you do not know the ordinances. Please take it upon yourselves to conserve. Be aware of your surroundings. Be good stewards. And we have from the Chicago Tribune, can private screeners do the job of the TSA? Those of us of a certain age remember the grainy security videos of on September 11, 2001, when bored and inattentive private screeners let murderers and hijackers through checkpoints. That led Congress to create the Federal Transportation Security Administration with widespread support from Americans who never wanted to see that happen again. But that was nearly 25 years ago, a very different era when it comes to screening technology. Tampa International Airport, Des Moines International Airport, and Charleston International Airport now say they plan to transition through 2027 to the TSA's new Gold Plus program, a voluntary public-private partnership program that allows airports to use private security screeners and eventually private investment in screening technology under TSA oversight. TSA remains a regulator, which is crucial, but not the operator. But the federal government still writes the rules, sets the standards, oversees compliance, and enforces security requirements. Private companies simply manage the checkpoints and screening workforce. It is privately operated but federally regulated airport security. Prospect of seeing their membership roles and their jobs pipeline diminish is unwelcome news to union labor unions. The American Federation of Government Employees, which represents nearly 50,000 TSA employees, must see the writing on the wall for numerous union jobs should Gold Plus be taken up more widely. We are unsurprised that unions would resist any such whiff of further privatization with every fiber of their being. Union leaders can fight for their workers' job security. These three airports, however, are within their rights to try something new. But is it really that new? The discussion over privatizing airport security hasn't taken widespread root across the country, but the seeds were planted decades ago. The TSA already has a privatization option airports can pursue, its screening partnership program, which launched in 2024. The legal framework for SPP is even older, being part of the Aviation Transportation Security Act 2001 that establishes the TSA. 20 airports leverage it already. This should largely dispel concerns about the novelty of such ideas. Gold Plus is merely the expansion enhancement of a program that was built into the U.S. post 9/11 airport security model. And for folks who argue, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Sure, with big change, especially in an industry as big and important as aviation, comes risk. Again, however, this is not far-reaching change, some would have you believe. After the ATSA passed, Congress required TSA to run SPP as a pilot program with 5 airports, including San Francisco. These airports have operated under TSA oversight since that pilot began in 2002 without demonstrating that the model itself compromises security. During the most recent shutdown in the spring, San Francisco International Airport, where private contractors have staffed checkpoints for more than 2 decades, continued operating relatively normally while some federally staffed airports struggle with long security lines and staffing shortages. Finally, countries such as Canada and the United Kingdom structure airport security in ways that make screening less dependent on the kind of federal budget standoffs that repeatedly disrupt U.S. airports. Some promote a solution to shut down airport security gridlock that would require Congress to pass legislation providing that TSA security workers continue to get paid even in the event of future issues. That's one reasonable option. Gold Plus and SPP are another, and one that's available to test right now without having to wait for the slow wheels of the federal government to grind into gear. We suspect private companies could get the latest technology in place far quicker than a TSA that has to deal with federal government rules. Washington has repeatedly demonstrated it can't keep airport screening insulated from political dysfunction. Rather than arguing endlessly over theories, we are open to further experimentation to find out what actually works. If Gold Plus succeeds, we say expand it. If it doesn't, don't. Safety has to always be the top priority over every other factor. And by Tom Waters, we have commentary. Elderly indeed. A headline in a recent Eagle Tribune article caught my eye. It was actually a local police log, and the lead story was about a man described as elderly. It went on to describe a man who had a confrontation with a clerk in a local discount store. He apparently pulled out a gun, and the police were called. A most unfortunate incident. However, what alarmed me was that the man, as reported, was 70 years old. Wait, that's 3 years younger than I am, and I'm definitely not elderly. Elderly is that Dick Van Dyke character in Mary Poppins. And no, I'm not talking about his chimney sweep. I'm referencing the chairman of the bank, the old guy with a long beard stooped over with the cane. The reporter of the police log should be sternly rebuked for his impertinence. Years ago, my wife and I would visit her grandmother, who was in a nursing home. She complained that everyone here is so old. We hated to point out that she was in her mid-90s at the time, so we let it go with a smile. In our 20s and 30s, we could do that. I have a former colleague and dear friend that when I asked how he was, he would respond to able to be upright and take nourishment. I concluded that as long as I could meet those two conditions, I was in the prime of life, nowhere near elderly, and I'm still not. I go to the grocery store most days, which her daughter tells me is ridiculous. According to her, I should be planning to head out once a week with a carefully prepared list on my phone, no less. I don't think so. I keep a pad in the kitchen, adding items as needed to my daily excursion. That way, my visits to the store are like meet and greet. I know many of the cashiers and baggers by name, and for better or worse, they know me. That is a mark of a bright, sensitive, and knowledgeable senior, definitely not an elderly person. Those are the people who need my smiling assistance reaching items on the top shelf. Our nephew's son, came recently to apply a coat of stain to the pergola by the back door. I've been meaning to do it myself for a while, in truth, since last fall when I replaced a board. The board has been gleaming nakedly at me every time I come by. I told myself it was curing, which of course it was for the first couple of months. I kept telling my wife I'd get to it until she finally insisted that we hire Daniel to come and do it. He did a splendid job, by the way. He also did it in less than a day. I, on the other hand, could have spread it out a bit. And that, I think, is the primary difference between an active senior and an elderly person. The senior just hasn't gotten around to finishing tasks. We're honestly just too busy. The elderly person, in stark contrast, just can't do it. I look at things around the house and tell myself I'll let it go. I'll get to it in a day or two, but I know that I still can't. I'm smugly confident that way until my wife brings me down a peg or two and suggests hiring someone. I go out and work in the garden for an hour or two when the weather's good. I come back in, take some pain reliever for my arthritis, and then plan my nap. Does that sound like an elderly person to you? I thought not. My late father-in-law used to comment when doing work around the house that it kills me to work on my knees. Yes, I get that because his joints aches. Because the joint aches aside, there's a question of being able to get up again. I had a breakfast this past week with a good friend who hasn't been well for a while. I asked him what he was planning to do for the rest of the day. He really wanted to plant some flowers on the family grave nearby. I offered help, and we did. It took a while, and they looked really nice when we were done, but we both realized that we'd have to get down to plant. That we could do, but getting up again made both of us a little dizzy. Most of the time, I can do it with just slight hesitation and it's personal triumph. As I said, it may take a while, but here I am, moving about with a high degree of satisfaction, able to be upright and take nourishment. So I continue my vibrant, youthful existence free of reminders of age and decline, which those pesky phone calls about my eligibility for the final expenses reimbursements and Medicare Advantage plans, which I'm sure are scammers. I look at the president climbing slowly up the stairs of Air Force One, or Senator Mitch McConnell staring blankly into a camera lens. That's elderly. I'm still up and about each morning, reading my newspaper, sipping my coffee, planning my trip to the grocery store or Home Depot. No matter that, I'll probably fall asleep during our British murder mysteries anytime after Jeopardy. I've probably seen them before anyway, or I'll find out from my wife over breakfast the next day who did it. Again, that was by Tom Waters. And let's go to the... Just a couple minutes left here, so we will find, hopefully, the Dear Abby, and that'll be about all we have time for. Dear Annie, recently I had a major social misstep that has essentially pushed one of my best friends out of my life. During the week of my birthday, I had a mid-30s crisis. A string of bad memories from dating and bad luck with women hit me and put me in a very emotionally weakened state of mind in front of this friend. I was reduced to what felt like a whimpering fool complaining about my bad luck with dating and women. 2 days later, I was back to my normal self and saw her at my birthday dinner with friends. During the dinner, she was distant from me, which was fine. I gave her space with the hopes that she would enjoy herself with our friends. At the end of the night, when people started saying their goodbyes, she kept saying, "I need a social detox." And when I heard that, I just said, "Okay," and kept my cool in front of our friends as we parted our ways. Since that night over 4 months ago, we have had very limited contact. The only time we spoke on the phone since then was when I called her to wish her happy birthday. While appreciative, she still wanted to detox. I've seen her with mutual friends, but we have not really spent time together since my social misstep. She did reach out to me after sports injury, and we did spend time among our groups of friends and had a small conversation together, but it still feels like our relationship is strange. It's sad, too, because we used to hang out almost every weekend and would tell each other anything going on. Unfortunately, my sad mind state during the week of my birthday was very off-putting to her. I know we still care about and value each other, and I want to get our friendship back on track. However, I feel this is more of a breakup versus friends taking time apart. What can I do? Can this friendship be saved? Dear missteps, a social misstep is not enough to end a 10-year friendship. In fact, that is exactly what friends are for, to help each other when we are at our lowest, or as you say, in our emotionally weakened state of mind. Sounds like there is something more going on here. Could there be other points of tension in your relationship to this woman? Is this a pattern of behavior for you? I would do some self-reflection and then clearly, concisely tell her exactly what you told me in this letter, that you value your friendship and hope to get it back on track. Dear Annie, the story from getting old and going in circles who is being dragged down by your long-term boyfriend sounds so familiar. I left my husband at 37 years, just before my 60th birthday. I am fortunate to be financially stable. However, even if I weren't, I would have left him. You can't realize how bad it is until you get out. Then after a while, you begin to bloom, and the world awaits you. It took me years of counseling to put my needs before his. I hope she doesn't wait that long. There's a fabulous life waiting for her. Good luck. Been there. Dear Ben there, thank you for sharing your inspiring story. It's never too late to claim the life you deserve. And that's what we have time for today. You have been listening to you've been listening to Lowell Associations for Minds, LAB Radio. LAB Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. LAB would like to thank UMass Lowell's WUMLFM for providing the radio signal that allows us to broadcast 5 days a week. Thank you. There are many ways you may listen to LAB Radio. Request a free specialized radio receiver, or for more information about our radio reading service, call LAB at 978-454-5704. You can listen to LAB Radio anytime by dialing 1-631-359-9069 or visit our website where you can tune in to LAB Radio at LowellAssociationForTheBlind.org. This has been Barry. Thank you for listening to us today. We hope you enjoy the rest of your day. We will talk to you again. We will always try to do better.